Northeast Nebraska residents are picking up after storms and tornadoes roared through last night. Two tornadoes touched down in the town of Kearney. There was a train derailment and damage to parks, roofs, and airport hangars. The Red Cross has set up shelters for people the storm system has left homeless. There have been no reports of injuries or deaths. Nebraska's governor has declared a state of emergency. That allows communities to access state and federal resources. Talks about a possible merger between U.S. Airways and United Airlines are off. Both companies' CEOs say it's not the right time for a link-up. They'd been exploring the idea for more than 2 months, and a merger would have created the world's largest airline. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, offering continental breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated and newly remodeled. Second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry that we're not going to be able to bring you this first hour, the program that we had planned. We were not able to hook up with Eric Lischblau. He's a staff reporter at the New York Times. We were going to be talking about his book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. Every once in a while it happens, we just can't reach the guest at the appointed time, and we will see if we can get that program rescheduled and do it on another day. So I think it's definitely worth having that conversation. So instead, we will go into the Focus 580 archives for a program from about a year ago, a show that we first broadcast last June, a conversation with Steve Fogel about his book, The Pentagon, which is a history of that building and how it was built. So as you listen to this first hour Focus, keep in mind that we'll not take calls, but we will be back here live, hour number two, with Dr. Suzanne Troopen to take your calls on women's health. In this first hour of our show today, we will look back to one of the greatest construction feats in American history. It was accomplished in just 17 months, and the result remains the biggest office building in the world. And certainly, we're talking about a building that today is a symbol of America and American power that, for good or ill, is recognized around the world. The building that we're talking about is the Pentagon. And our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Steve Fogel. He's a veteran military reporter for The Washington Post, and he is the author of a newly published book that is a history of the Pentagon, not of the Department of Defense, but of the building itself and how it came to be built. The book is published by Random House. It's recently out, and it is titled The Pentagon, A History. And we'll be talking about it this morning in this part of the show. Let me just tell you a little bit more about our guest, Steve Fogel. His coverage of the war in Afghanistan was part of a package of Washington Post stories that was selected as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2002. He covered the September 11 terrorist attack on the Pentagon, and after that reported on the victims of the attack and on the building's reconstruction. He's also covered the war in Iraq, the first Gulf War, as well as U.S. military operations in Rwanda, Somalia, and the Balkans. Mr. Fogel, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. People, I guess, they have the idea that that this is a big building. And as I mentioned at the beginning, one of the things frequently that you hear mentioned is the fact that it's the biggest office building in the world. I think one of the things that gives you a basis of comparison is that it's the size of two Empire State Buildings?
Well, they originally were going to make it the size of two Empire State Buildings, but they kept building during World War II, and they kept on adding more space, and the end result is that it's about three times the size of the Empire State Building.
So it's a big building. So give us some other, some kind of numbers just to sort of establish just how big a building we're talking about.
Well, one way to think about it is that it's a full mile around the building. Each of the five sides is about a fifth of a mile long, so it's quite a stroll to get around it. 6.2 million square feet which makes it definitely the largest office building in the world by a long shot. It's something that was such a large building when it was proposed back in 1941, when people realized that you could fit five of the U.S. Capitol buildings into the Pentagon and still have room left over. People were quite amazed at this and couldn't understand what the possible need would be for such a large building.
Well, certainly at the time that it was proposed and built, this was in the run up to World War II. Although it was the ground was actually broken before Pearl Harbor, it certainly was the time when the military was feeling the need for space. And it was scattered in a variety of buildings around Washington. And in fact, there was another building, a relatively new building that was put up at some expense. Who came along and said, well, look, what we really need here, we have such a need for space, and it would make sense for all of the Department of Defense to be in one building. Why don't we just build one very large building and put everybody in it?
Well, the climate of the time is very important for considering how it came along. This was before Pearl Harbor, but there was a real wartime atmosphere in Washington in the summer of 1941. France had fallen the previous year. The Nazis were halfway to Moscow. Britain was in grave danger, and President Franklin Roosevelt had declared a national emergency in May of 1941. And the War Department was in the midst of this enormous buildup, eightfold increase in the size of the army. And as you mentioned, the War Department headquarters was spread out in 17 different buildings all over town, in garages and warehouses, apartment buildings. It was remarkably inefficient. There were some suggestions that that for the emergency, some sort of temporary building or buildings be put up that the War Department could move into. They had indeed just opened a new War Department headquarters in the Foggy Bottom neighborhood of Washington in April, but they were already finding that they didn't have enough space. They needed more, and the chief of Army Construction, a general named Brian Somerville, in July 1941, put together this secret proposal that one large, enormous building be constructed that would be large enough to house the entire War Department. And he brought his staff together one night in July 1941 and told them he wanted a building large enough for 40,000 people, more than 4 million square feet, 10,000 cars, and he wanted the plans on his desk by Monday morning. That was the pace at which they were moving.
Mm-hmm.
And the result... the following Monday, they did have the plans, and that was the primitive form of what would become the Pentagon.
I think it's interesting here that the man that you would have to consider to be the father of the Pentagon, of the building, is this man, General Somerville, and that it was not the President of the United States, it was not the Secretary of Defense, it was not the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, it was the man who was the head of the construction division who saw the need, but he was really the one, and this seems pretty far down the chain of command for a decision like that to have been made. And of course, as you explain in the book, it's somebody that now has kind of been forgotten. Nobody now knows who. Well, I don't know. Military historians and people who know about the Pentagon, maybe you know about this man, but now his name is certainly not well known now.
That's right. Somerville is largely forgotten today. I mean, he truly was one of the giants of World War II in terms of what he accomplished. He was made chief of logistics by George C. Marshall, and he oversaw the supplying of 8 million U.S. Army troops around the globe, from the Pacific to Normandy to North Africa. In terms of Somerville coming up with this on his own, he had a mandate from General George C. Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, and from Secretary of War Henry Stimson to solve this problem. And he just thought big. He thought temporary buildings weren't going to be adequate, and he put together this proposal for a large permanent building, and he quickly won over Marshall. Stimson was a little bit embarrassed about having to ask for a new War Department building since they had just opened a new War Department building. But he swallowed his pride on that, and they went to Roosevelt within a week and got Roosevelt's approval. At this point, FDR had more or less reached the conclusion that the United States was not going to be able to avoid a war with Germany, and he was of the mind frame at that point that they needed to do what it took, and so he was amenable to this enormous building being created.
Yeah. And another, just to come back to the point we talked about a little bit about the beginning, about just how big a building this is, I think the other thing that's really remarkable about this story is the fact that not only is it an enormous building, but it was constructed in less than 2 years.
Oh, it was done in fantastic short order. Mm-hmm. I mean, they broke ground on the building on September 11th, 1941, and within 7.5 months, by the end of April 1942, they were moving people in. The first of the Pentagon employees were moved into the building, even as construction was continuing all around them. And the whole thing would be done in 17 months, even though they kept on increasing the size as they went along. They moving people in, they decided to add a fifth floor on top of everything else they had. So you had these new employees sitting in their offices, and concrete was being poured all around them, and there were some pretty amusing accidents where concrete just came pouring through rooms as secretaries and army officers were trying to get their work done. It was quite a scene.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Steve Vogel. He is a military reporter for The Washington Post and is the author of a recently published book that is a history of the building of the Pentagon, the building itself. And the book is The Pentagon, A History. It's published by Random House. We do have a caller here and would welcome others. Other folks want to be involved in the conversation. You can do that very easily by giving us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Kankakee, so we'll go right there on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Your caller wonders, why a Pentagon? That is to say, why a five-sided building? What possible architectural or aesthetic or, if you will, what possible feng shui justification could there have been for a Pentagon? This caller would wish to know.
All right. I'm sure that's one of the big questions that is always asked about this building is why,
right.
Why this five-sided building?
That's right. It's you know, a lot of people assume there must be some great symbolism to this. You know, some people speculate, the five sides represent the all the military services, if you include the Coast Guard or other theories. But the truth, as I read about in the book, is that this was essentially an accident born of the speed with which the Pentagon, or the headquarters building, was being built. When they got their marching orders to come up with a plan for this building over the course of one weekend in July 1941, the architects and designers sat down together, and they were trying to figure out how they could fit such a vast building into a tract of land. They couldn't build a tall building because there were restrictions on the use of steel, which was needed for munitions and battleships. So they needed to have a building that would be spread out. And they pondered this. They looked at a large rectangle, a large square, and the interior distances on such a large building would be pretty unwieldy, just the distances that people inside the building would have to travel. And ironically, the initial site where they were thinking about putting the building, where they wanted to build it, at the foot of the Memorial Bridge in Arlington, right below the Robert E. Lee Mansion, was a five-sided tract of land. It was bound on four sides by roads and railroads and another side by a long line of trees. And so the architects, over the course of this weekend, decided, you know, actually a Pentagon-shaped building would work best on this piece of land. And a Pentagon has some of the benefits of a large circle in that you have a flow of people and utilities within the building that would be more efficient than in a large square or rectangle. And that's what they came up with. And ironically, a month later, Franklin Roosevelt ordered them to move the site to a less prominent piece of ground because there were huge outcries about building below the Lee Mansion. And they moved it to a spot called Hell's Bottom, about a half mile down the river, And this was not a five-sided tract, but at this point, the project was moving ahead at such speed that the architects decided, well, there's not really time to change it, and besides, we kind of like it. And so they kept the Pentagon on their new site.
And I think also wasn't a part of it also that Franklin Roosevelt, something about the design, the uniqueness of the design appealed to him as well. He liked the idea of having something that would be unlike anything else.
That's right. There was a big storm of protest against the pentagonal shape from the Fine Arts Commission, which has a great deal of say over buildings that are put up in monumental Washington. And they thought that this pentagonal building would just be a complete mess. There hadn't been any sort of office building constructed like that before. Although, ironically, a Pentagon is a traditional shape of fortification. And Fort Sumter, for example, where the first shots of the Civil War were fired, is a five-sided fort. And there are other examples. But Roosevelt heard out the Fine Arts Commission and in the end decided, you know what, I like this Pentagon-shaped building because nothing like it's ever been done before. So he endorsed the design, and they stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. Here, I think this is also an interesting part of the story, the involvement of Roosevelt, who, unlike perhaps a lot of other presidents, most of them, was not only interested in architecture, dabbled in architecture, and he took a fairly strong personal interest in this project.
He sure did. Yeah, he had more interest in architecture than probably any other president since Thomas Jefferson. And he believed that the buildings that his administration left behind would have a longer, larger stamp on history than his own policies. And he took a great interest in the design of the Jefferson Memorial, in as well as the National Airport in Washington, and most certainly in the Pentagon. He was involved from start to finish in the design, in the materials used. At one point, Roosevelt proposed that they build the Pentagon without any windows. This was an experimental thing he wanted to try because the use of air conditioning and fluorescent lighting was expanding at that point, and it was thought that you could then build a large building without windows and courtyards and thereby save time, space, and money. And he made this proposal, and his own Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, who was thoroughly a product of the 19th century, was so appalled at this idea that he declared that he would refuse to work in a banana warehouse. So the idea went nowhere. Roosevelt dropped that one. But he certainly had a large impact on the design and materials used. He was the one who approved the use of limestone on the exterior faces of the wall of the Pentagon exteriors.
Also, what was remarkable to me, another feature of the story, is that Roosevelt apparently felt that after World War II, that the size of the military would contract again, that they wouldn't need this big building, that they would in fact move out, and that it would be used for something else.
That's right, and he wasn't alone in that. Almost everyone thought there wasn't any possible need for the military, for the Army, to have such a large building after this war, this temporary emergency, was over. And Roosevelt had a pet scheme of creating a large archive building for all the excess records in Washington, of which there are many. These were overflowing all the buildings in the District of Columbia. And Roosevelt gave instructions to General Somerville to design the building so that it could be converted into an archive after the war. And that meant putting in stronger floors. And instead of supporting 75 pounds per square foot, he had Somerville build them to 150 pounds per square foot, and so that they could support file cabinets. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the idea of turning it into archives, which Roosevelt held throughout the rest of his life up until the time right before Yalta, a couple months before he died in 1945, he reiterated that he wanted the Army out of the building after the war, and that it be converted into an archives. the that extra strength that was put in the building made a big difference 60 years later when the Pentagon was hit by a hijacked aircraft, because that additional resilience, from the stronger columns, the heavier use of concrete, made a big difference when the plane hit the building. Mm.
The building something like this, I'm sure that there would have been the number of construction firms in the United States that would be capable of a project like this would be relatively small, and mm-hmm. there were several that were perhaps considered or were in the running. How did they end up with the company that they did?
Well, John McShane, Philadelphia builder, was the main builder, and McShane had more or less situated himself as Franklin Roosevelt's favorite builder. McShane had built the Jefferson Memorial. He'd been so eager to build the Jefferson Memorial that he underbid his competitors to such an extent that he actually lost money building the memorial. McShane was motivated more by glory than cash. And Roosevelt really took a shine to McShane and hired him to build the FDR Library up in Hyde Park, New York, which was also constructed shortly before the Pentagon. So when Somerville was choosing builders, I think one of the reasons they selected McShane was that he knew that it would meet with Roosevelt's approval. It wasn't Roosevelt who chose McShane, but I think McShane was well situated because of his work that he'd done on Jefferson Memorial and the Hyde Park Library. They also added two Virginia builders to the mix, and this was another political move by Somerville. He knew that because the Pentagon was being constructed in Virginia, some of the most important support he would get on the project in Congress came from several powerful Virginia congressmen and Senator Carter Glass, who was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And it certainly helped his cause to have a couple of Virginia builders in the mix. They ended up not doing a whole lot in terms of the construction. It was really McShane, who was a marvelous builder, who was probably one of the best qualified builders in the country to take on this project, who did the bulk of the construction under unreasonably strict demands of time and also the a design that was constantly changing and expanding as they built.
Yeah, one of the stories that I think you tell in the book is that because of the pace of construction, the architectural drawings, the plans, they were just slightly ahead of the building effort, and in fact, in some cases, they went so fast that it was it later discovered that they didn't even have drawings for some of the building, for some
That's
parts
right.
of the building.
They were moving at a phenomenal pace, and the designers hadn't had much of a head start on designing the building. And when groundbreaking came in September 1941, they only had plans for 20 of some 5,000 pile caps that they were going to need to hold up the building. So you had the architects were set up in a hangar building on the old Washington Hoover Airfield. This was part of the big site where the Pentagon was being built, and they had 400 draftsmen sitting in there working the assembly line type conditions, churning out drawings 24 hours a day. The blueprint machines just pumping them out as quickly as they could, and then you had McShane's builders and the Army engineers running down there in the night and literally grabbing drawings off of the draftsmen's desks because they needed new drawings, and sometimes when they didn't have the drawings, they more or less guessed where they should put things. And there's all kinds of examples of columns and other features of the building that either are not marked on the original plans, or if they are marked, they're not marked in the right spot. It was quite an operation where they were at times the builder more or less likened it to trying to quarterback a team blindfolded, because you didn't know. He couldn't see ahead to see where the ball should be going, but they had to guess.
Is each side, each leg, essentially the same, so it's just the same construction repeated over five times, or are there substantial differences between each side of the building?
Well, that was one of the secrets to McShane's speed in building the Pentagon. He divided the structure up into five equal sites, sort of trapezoid-shaped parts of the building. And each one of them was built as a separate building with its own team, with its own superintendent, its own carpenters, its own administrators, own job foreman. And McShane did this in part to spur competition between the teams. He knew that there would be some administrative duplication, but that the competition between the teams would drive things forward. They were moving at a slightly different pace, so each section they were going clockwise around was slightly ahead of the next section, and that allowed them to sequence the delivery of building materials or specialized crews. The five buildings, so to speak, are essentially the same, but there were certain differences. There's basements and sub-basements under portions of the building, but not in other parts of the building, because the foundation conditions varied considerably. Closer to the Potomac River, near the lagoon, they were dealing with very low ground, very marshy ground, and they had to use a lot of fill there. And so there's actually more basement in some of those areas of the building than elsewhere. So essentially the Pentagon is a very concentric and identical building, but down in the basement in particular, there are a lot of differences.
Let me introduce again our guest. I think we're back up now at our full operating power. This is WILL Urbana, and this is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're talking this morning with Steve Vogel. He's a military reporter for The Washington Post, and he is the author of A New History of the Building of the Pentagon, that is, of the building itself, and it's The Pentagon, A History, The Untold Story of the Wartime Race to Build the Pentagon and to Restore It 60 Years Later. The book is published by Random House, and it should be out, available in bookstore if you want to read it. Questions are certainly welcome here on the program as well. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good for anyone who can hear us. You're listening over the air or on the internet. As long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. One thing that we have not yet talked about is the cost of the building, and one of the stories in here you tell is, in fact, of how the builders tried to conceal the cost from the Congress and from the press, and in fact, fairly consistently were dishonest about how much the building was going to cost, because they knew what it was going to cost, and they also knew that when everybody found out, there could be widespread unhappiness, particularly in the Congress, and so they simply lied about what it was costing.
Well, Somerville promised that the whole thing could be done for $35 million, and there was a lot of skepticism about that price, which in itself was an enormous amount of money for a building. You know, there were members of Congress who couldn't believe that one building could cost that much money. And one of the things that Somerville did was to more or less hide the sizes, the increase in the size of the building. As after Pearl Harbor, they were adding more space under the basement, and then a couple months later, they decided to add the fifth floor. And in his report to Congress, Somerville listed the fifth floor as a fourth floor intermediate. So there are various accounting tricks like that where they weren't putting all the costs on the ledger. He had promised that the roads would be included as part of that $35 million, but they ended up separating that from their figure and not disclosing that they'd taken that out. At the same time, the final price was about $75 million, which in current dollars is about maybe $950 million. Thereabouts, which is a pretty remarkably cheap figure in comparison to a lot of public works projects these days. The project was labeled Somerville's Folly at the time because people thought that he had, because the truth did come out before too long that they're fantastically over budget, and the Pentagon itself was the first Pentagon cost overrun. But there was a general acknowledgement as time went on that the money had actually been well spent.
Well, we have someone else to bring in here to the conversation, someone in Farina on our toll-free line, this line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. There's an author I've heard speak about how his father worked at the Pentagon in the early 60s, and when they would, his mother and he as a boy would go to visit, they'd have lunch out in the Central Plaza area. I'm not sure that's what it's called, but in the central area, outdoors there, and there were these covers, and he reported how his father told him not to sit on one, that it was actually an anti-aircraft missile that was in the ground there, that it could pop open and fire at a enemy aircraft. Do you know anything about any kind of anti-aircraft missiles or anything like that in the central courtyard area? And he reported this in relation to the 9/11 attack, that he was under the impression that something like that would still be there. And that's my question, if you knew anything about that and how the 9/11 attack could have happened, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, well.
Well, the central courtyard that you're referring to, it is a very large five-plus acres in the middle of the building that is now actually under a bit of construction. There was a hot dog stand in the middle of the courtyard, and for years and years that was known as the Ground Zero Cafe, because the expectation was, the rumor was, that the Soviets did have it zeroed in as their first missile that they would fire in the event of a nuclear war. I think the idea that there were that there were missiles in the ground there in the courtyard is a bit of a tall tale. Certainly, though, with 9/11, there have been some additional defenses that have been brought into the Washington area to defend against a similar attack. I don't think there's anything, though, in the Pentagon courtyard.
I think that I also read somewhere, and you tell me if this is true, that in talking about the Ground Zero area there in the middle, that at one time somebody for a joke actually painted a target there, and that later it was painted over. I think it was after September 11th it was painted over. Is that true?
No, I haven't heard that. I know that there wasn't any target painted there after 9/11, but at the same time, there was very much a realization from the beginning that this design, this large building, made what, in fact, the Fine Arts Commission described as the world's largest bombing target. It looked like a bombing target, and there was concern that, you know, for enemy aircraft, if the Germans or Japanese sent bombers over, which was a real fear among many people at the time, that this would make the easiest target in the world. And there's always been a sense of fatalism among Pentagon employees who realize that, you know, this large consolidated mass there along the Potomac River has always been a bit of a sitting duck in terms of being a target. And that's true. It was true 50, 60 years ago, and it's true today.
Well, was there at any point early on in the discussions of the design, was there any conversation about some kind of defense putting in place around the building to defend it against that kind of attack?
Well, that's right. During World War II, after Pearl Harbor, there was quite a bit of discussion back and forth about what additional bomb-proofing steps they should take in the building, that they actually brought up again Roosevelt's idea of building the Pentagon without windows to protect against bombs. There was talk about building a large underground shelter in the parking lot, about three or four stories into the ground, that could house the top command in the event of a bombing raid. There are other design modifications that they talked about. But in the end, Roosevelt nixed those. His point was that, well, if we have to do this for the Pentagon, we will have to do it for every government building, and, you know, it's just something that can't be afforded. So they they more or less kept with the initial design. But it's always been a concern, and there's certainly now, post 9/11, as the renovation of the Pentagon continues, there have been a lot of structural improvements that have been made in terms of the building materials, the blast-resistant windows that, ironically, had been put up on the one section of the Pentagon which was actually hit on 9/11. The renovation was underway, and the hijacked aircraft hit the one part of the Pentagon that had been renovated, and those blast-resistant windows and the some steel supports that were added behind the limestone facade made a difference and also saved lives, in addition to the that original stout construction that they put in so it could be converted into an archives after the war.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that that perhaps the man who was considered to be, although now his name is maybe not widely remembered, the man who would be considered to be the father of the building was a man named Brehon Sommervall, who was an Army officer. He was, by this time, I think we're talking about, he was a general. He was head of the Army's construction division, and his task was to come up with enough space to house this rapidly growing defense establishment. And he sort of said, well, look, why don't we just go big and we'll just build one big building and put everybody in it. So he was the man at the top. It's interesting also that the second in command in this project is someone whose name now is certainly remembered in connection with another big project, and that was Leslie Groves, the man who later would go on to head the Manhattan Project, which was the effort to build the atomic bomb. He was the number two guy here. What was his role?
That's right. He was Sommervall's deputy, and he was like Sommervall. He was just more force of nature than a human being in some ways. They were the two of them in combination were quite a formidable pair. Groves, as the deputy chief of construction, was overseeing domestic construction around the country for the U.S. Army in this time of phenomenal building, particularly after Pearl Harbor. There was just a tremendous amount of construction going on all across the United States in terms of weapons depots, training facilities, ports, and Groves was overseeing all that, but in particular, he was maintaining a close grip on the Pentagon construction because it was such a critical part of the whole program. And he was there quite regularly. There was a constructing engineer, Major Clarence Renshaw, who had direct supervision of the project. But Groves was a fierce taskmaster who was constantly looking over his shoulder, was constantly driving people forward to meet deadlines or to exceed deadlines. You know, lots of micromanaging, just driving his subordinates crazy. Groves has been described as a Sommervall without the charm. You know, Sommervall's nickname was Dynamite in a Tiffany Box. He was a very charming, refined gentleman. And Groves, nobody ever called Groves charming, but his drive, his ability to move programs ahead was really unmatched, and that ultimately was why Sommervall chose him to be head of the Manhattan Project. He was selected in September of 1942. Groves was appalled because this Manhattan Project was seen as sort of this dead-end job. It was only supposed to be about a $100 million project, which was pocket change as far as Groves was concerned. But Sommervall knew that if there was one officer who could drive this program forward to success, it would be Groves. And for a time, Groves was supervising the construction of the Pentagon as well as the construction of the atomic bomb at the same time for about 5 or 6 months there. He was doing both and driving them both forward to completion more rapidly than most people thought was possible.
Yeah, it's still. I guess I keep coming back to the idea that here, what continues to be today the biggest office building in the world, an enormous building, was built in 17 months. And even though some features of the design, the fact that it was in some ways essentially one piece that was repeated five times, so you could essentially do the same thing all the way around. And they had many people working on it, in addition to the construction people, many architects and designers and engineers. And they broke it down into pieces, so one person would work on one thing and somebody else would work on something else. But someone had to come along and then essentially be responsible for taking all the pieces and fitting them together in one building and making sure that they indeed all did fit together. I'm still kind of, it's just the idea of the scale of it is still kind of staggering.
That's right. Yeah, and they had a large team of architects and engineers who were, you know, working all this time to make sure the whole thing was leveled correctly and that the pieces would fit together. I mean that could have been a huge disaster, of course, if it hadn't. But you know, despite the speed with which they were building, and they were taking quite a few shortcuts, and in fact, one of the executive officer for the project, a wonderful man named Bob Furman, who was on the staff of Leslie Groves, and he's still in the Washington area, and he was a wonderful source of information for this this book. He told me the story of occasionally they would strip down the columns that supposedly had been poured, and they'd found out that they'd forgotten to pour them. They were moving at that fast of a pace. But in the end, despite the shortcuts that were taken and despite some of the mistakes in design and construction, the Pentagon proved to be a pretty well-constructed building. Certainly it proved that on 9/11. At the same time, over the years, there was a lot of deterioration, particularly in the basement. There were just because of this marsh ground that they were building on top of, they had a lot of groundwater problems, and the slab in many places was sinking down, you know, buckling down a foot or more. And describe in the book this incident on the eve of the first Gulf War, 1990, as the first U.S. troops were moving into Saudi Arabia to defend against a possible Iraqi invasion. A pipe burst in the basement of the Pentagon, and you had millions and millions of gallons of water just spilling into the building and flooding the Air Force Command Center down in the basement, and they were trying to oversee the movement of F-15s into the country, and the officers down there were up to their ankles and even their kneecaps in water. So it was quite the building was not holding up particularly well at that point, and that was one of the things that spurred the huge renovation that was finally undertaken beginning about 1994.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Steve Vogel. He's a military reporter for the Washington Post and is author of a recently published book that takes a look at the history of the Pentagon, not of the Department of Defense, but of the building itself, how it was constructed, and something about, which we really haven't talked very much about, also something about life in the Pentagon, what it was like to work in the building, some stories coming out of that. The book is published by Random House. It's out now. We have somebody here who would like to call in, and we do have an opportunity here for another 5 or 10 minutes here to take calls from people who are listening. 333-9455 is the Champaign Urbana number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And the caller is in Champaign. It's line one.
Hello? Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I missed a little bit of your program, and so maybe you've talked about this. But I would like to know why it is we're still told that a large airliner hit the Pentagon when there's absolutely no evidence in the first pictures of the damage to indicate that.
Well, Mr. Vogel, can you talk about that?
Well, you know, it's one of these questions that come up. You know, I find it kind of amazing, having, you know, covered the funerals of people who were aboard the plane that hit the building and talked to their relatives and talked to numerous witnesses who saw the aircraft and the you know, this sort of this urban myth that's developed that there's no physical evidence showing that a plane hit the building, and I have to say that that's completely untrue. You can, you know, out on the internet, you can find all kinds of theories, but I have to say, at the end of the day, it's pretty disrespectful to the 184 people who died at the Pentagon that day to suggest that, you know, that this was some sort of conspiracy.
So there is no doubt in your mind, as far as you're concerned, that that indeed is what happened. That there was
none whatsoever.
The hijacked plane was deliberately flown into the building, and that's what caused the damage.
I don't have any doubt.
Yeah. Well, other questions are welcome to 333-9455, still free, 800-222-9455. Once the building was constructed here, they had the enormous task of moving people into it, moving people around it. How did they, because, you know, there are a lot of famous stories about people getting lost, jokes and otherwise, how did people adjust, how the people who were working in there adjust to dealing with this enormous space and getting around in this enormous space?
It was, you know, from the moment it opened, it entered American mythology as just this vast labyrinth, and the stories of people getting lost are legion. You know, everybody from George C. Marshall to Dwight Eisenhower, first time Eisenhower was in the building by himself as Army Chief of Staff, he managed to get lost and was wandering around for 10 or 15 minutes before he finally asked a couple of secretaries how to get to the Chief of Staff's office, and they said, well, you just passed it 10 feet back, General. There were a lot of stories like that. There was an interesting numbering system that they came up with from the beginning that Groves complained that the system seemed like a procurement authority because it used five-digit letters and numbers together, and you had to you couldn't remember which referred to the floor and which referred to the ring and this, that, and the other. But once people understood this system, it turned out to be a pretty foolproof way to get around the building. And in theory, if you know where you're going, supposedly you can get to any point in the building within about 7 minutes. I'm not sure that that's true in practice, but you know, people who've been there a while swear by the system, and even people who've been there for many, many years will occasionally find themselves lost, but there are systems for getting your way around the building.
Is it true that for some period of time, this was essentially an open building? It was open to the public? Anybody who wanted to could walk in and walk around the Pentagon?
That's right. It was quite secure during World War II, but soon afterwards, immediately at the end of the war, they opened it up, dropped all restrictions. And during the years of the Cold War, it was a remarkably open building. People were constantly coming in, tourists wandering around, and there were some spies from the Polish embassy and other Warsaw Pact countries who love to come down to the Pentagon and just wander over to some of the cafeterias or wander around the stacks in the Army Library, and they picked up all kinds of information, just eavesdropping on officers, talking about new weapon systems or different policy changes, and that continued all through the 60s, you know, through the Vietnam era, and even in 1972, the Weather Underground was able to send a team in to case the joint, and just they walked in with a bomb that they planted on the fourth floor in the women's bathroom and exploded that. They were able to come through unchallenged, and you know, that very nearly killed the four cleaning ladies who had been in that bathroom just a little bit earlier. And there were a lot of episodes where people who shouldn't have been in the building were constantly coming in. It finally, security began increasing in the 1980s after you had the Beirut bombings and some other incidents like that. And by the 1990s, they had really upped it considerably. And now it's to the point post 9/11 where it's very difficult without the proper clearance to get into the building. They do take tours around, but that's something that has to be cleared in advance.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have someone here, I believe, in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I did have a couple of short questions. I guess they're short. But I just wanted to respond to the dismissal of the conspiracy. I dismiss it somewhat, too, but I've studied it, and I just don't think that it offends the memory of the people that were killed there. I think you should place it on the blame for the lack of credibility in the current government, as opposed to anything else. But that's an aside. There's an apocryphal story that they built it so fast that some people weren't found. Have you heard anything like that?
Well, there are always rumors about workers who fell into the concrete and are embedded in columns or, you know, some wall. And that's something that's been, stories that have been told like that over the years. There were a lot of people killed in the construction of the Pentagon. Eight workers died, and they had a very poor accident rate. But from all the interviews and records I've reviewed, I think it's pretty clear that no one actually was embedded in the concrete. Clarence Renshaw, the construction engineer who oversaw the construction, left behind a recollection for his son where he said, well, if that had happened, I would have known about it. And there's no record in any of the voluminous reports at the Corps of Engineers of anyone dying in those fashions. So if there are people still lost in the building, they haven't come out yet.
Yeah. I didn't know. I was going to ask about how many fatalities, because a large construction project there typically are, and if you're rushing it, it's worse. But there's Basovich's cultural history of the Pentagon would be a good companion piece. I don't know if you've ever done a book chat with him, but he's there in D.C., or up in Boston, actually, come to think of it. He's the fellow that just lost his son in Iraq. He did an interesting book, and I think he's been on the show, actually, probably.
Yes, I studied with him, actually. He's a wonderful gentleman.
I see. I'm wondering if, going back to the time of the 911, there was this story floating around that the part that was a hit was actually being upgraded to some kind of state-of-the-art
That's right.
Full spectrum dominance kind of place, or something like that, or is that true?
The whole building was undergoing a renovation, but they were doing it wedge by wedge. They divided it into five wedges, and the section that was hit was the first part of the building that was constructed, and it was also the first part of the building that had been renovated. So it did have additional fortification in terms of blast-resistant windows. It had a sprinkler system. The Pentagon was remarkably out of date in terms of any kinds of code compliance, handicapped access, fire safety, electrical. So the one section that was hit there was the section that was best able to cope with the attack. And maybe the most fortunate part of it was that because it was under renovation, it wasn't fully occupied. There could have easily been twice or more as many people in that area that day were it not for the renovation.
I'm sorry to say I'm going to jump up here. I wish that we had more time, because there certainly is more we could talk about, including the part of the book that is about life in the Pentagon and around the Pentagon after the building was actually completed and dedicated. So for people who are listening, if you'd like to read more on the subject, this is the book to look for. It's The Pentagon, A History. It's published by Random House by our guest Steve Vogel. He is a military reporter for The Washington Post. The book is just out now, and I'm sure you could find it in the bookstore in the library. Mr. Vogel, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast this show June 27th of last year. Many other interviews available at will.illinois.edu. And also want to mention that we have rescheduled the interview that we were going to do this morning with Eric Lischblau from the New York Times, talking about his book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. We will talk with him on June 27th at 11 o'clock. The program Focus 580, made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign, Urbana since 1982. Bodywork offers four area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. In the next hour, we'll be taking your questions on women's health. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Prices are firmer all across the pitch. Let's look at the particulars. in Kansas City. July wheat, $7.99 up 5. September, $8.11 up 5. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, $7.57 up 13.5. September, $7.69.5 up 10.25. December, $7.95 up 14. July corn, $5.91.75 up 9.5. September, $6.04.5 up 9.25. December, $6.17.75 up 8.25. March of 2009, $6.30.75 up 7.75. July soybeans, $13.45.5 up 22.75. August, $13.54 up 25.75. November, $13.38 up 16.5. July soybean meal, $3.40.50 up 8.70. July soybean oil, $60.78.